Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, my name is Graham Oliver, the founder member of Saxon, still rocking after all these years. And you're listening to Talking Metal. It's going to rock the hairs off your legs. Be there or be square.
This is Grace Maiden Metal, rhythm guitar from Judas Priestess.
And this is Militia, lead vocals in Judas Priestess. And you're listening to
Talking Metal.
Perfect.
This is Damon Fox from Big Elf, and you're listening to Talking Metal. You're one step closer to doom.
Hello, this is Tony Iommi, and you're listening to Talking Metal.
Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne, and you're listening to Talking Metal.
Everybody, what the hell's going on? This is Zach Wild from Black Label Society and the Ozzy Osbourne Band, and we're all doing a hang, throwing back some cold ones, and we're talking metal. Take it easy.
This is Blasco from Ozzy Osbourne. You're listening to Talking Metal.
Mark Striegel, John Astronomy, the Talking Metal Podcast, coming to you from the Silver Spacecraft. I'm Bud Friendly, and now your hosts, Mark and John.
Hey guys, Happy New Year. John Astronomy here with Mark Striegel. Welcome to episode 335 of Talking Metal. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing good. We're here at Tonic, directly across the street from where we once had lunch with Richard Christie. I think at Pearl, wasn't it? Pearls, yeah. I was just watching that clip up on YouTube, and you're eating, and I'm like stretching across the table holding a microphone over to Richard, who is coincidentally back in the studio with Charred Walls of the Dam doing a second record. Looking forward to hearing that. And our first hang of the new year. So belated Happy New Year to John Astronomy.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you and your family as well, Mark. And we're really glad to be back. 2011 is going to be a great year for Talking Metal. We're going to tell you about all the cool stuff that's going to happen, including a brand new website. And I want to mention that silver spacecraft is right out front.
Yeah, it goes everywhere with us here at Talking Metal. We always have this silver spacecraft ready to go. On that note, here's a little Ozzy Osbourne.
Waiting for darkness, playing with fire, but there's been
That was Waiting for Darkness by the one, the only Ozzy Osbourne, featuring Jakey Lee on the guitar. And Mark, I do want to clarify that the recent bird deaths and fish deaths are not due to the Silver Spacecraft's atmospheric influence on this, you know, planet.
Correct, correct. We are very honored because we have one of the founding members of the great band Saxon, always one of my favorites. His name, Graham Oliver, and wow, he really has some great stories to share with you guys today. Everything from hanging out with Randy Rhoads and Ozzy Osbourne back in the day to touring with Saxon, to seeing Hendrix play live, to his recent shows that he's going to be doing. Probably they may have already passed by the time you hear this interview, but with Oliver Dawson Saxon, which is basically Steve Dawson and Graham Oliver, they go out and they play Saxon tunes, you know, the way they should be heard, and fun stuff. And of course, the band Saxon, Biff's version of Saxon, is also still out there. So big thanks to Graham Oliver for joining us on Talking Metal. How about we get into a little old school Saxon right now, John? This is Heavy Metal Thunder by Saxon.
That was Heavy Metal Thunder by Saxon. That comes from 1980's Strong Arm of the Law. And you can get that on iTunes.
Yeah, we'll possibly throw a link up in today's show notes for that. So if you use those links to buy that song, that of course helps Talking Metal. It's a great way to support what we do here. Yeah, so I'm excited. We are at some point this year, hopefully earlier this year, 2011, going to have kind of a new version of the site going up at talkingmetal.com, which is the best place to keep in touch with us. Buy a Talking Metal t-shirt to show your support of Talking Metal. And I guess we're ready to get into the interview with Graham Oliver, founding member of Saxon. How about we hear a little Oliver Dawson's Saxon with their version, their live version of the Saxon classic, Power and the Glory, which is also up on iTunes. Just search Oliver Dawson Saxon. You'll see they have a ton of classic Saxon songs up there, live versions of them, that is. And this sounds great, and it's just Power and the Glory has always been one of my favorite records, not just by Saxon, but period.
Great, Mark. So then after the track, we'll get into the interview, and then we'll end today's show with the track Annabelle, which comes from Graham Oliver's solo project, which is called End of an Era. And this is a great song. It's a little more alternative than metal, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Thanks, guys. Send us an email at talkingmetal@yahoo.com. Here is Oliver Dawson Saxon with Power and the Glory live, and then right into our interview with Graham Oliver.
Yeah.
Hey, is that Mark?
Yeah, it's Mark Striegel. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Well, thank you for staying up late to do this interview with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I've been watching James Bond.
Oh, very nice.
What, it was on TV.
What era James Bond are you watching? Sean Connery or Roger Moore or the new guy?
Actually, well, Pierce Brosnan, the one that watches Bond, yeah.
Right, very good. Well, thank you again, Graham, for joining us on Talking Metal. I know you are about to head out on the road, and you're going to be doing some more gigs with the Oliver Dawson Saxon.
That's right. We're doing three shows Thursday. We leave Thursday, and we're doing three in, I think, one in Holland and two in Belgium. And then we just a week later, we do the Finland Metal Fest.
Okay, cool. And what... When fans go to see one of these shows, are they getting all the great old Saxon stuff that we love so much?
Yeah, pretty much. We have got a new album, so we always do some new songs as well. And some of the songs, because when the first thing we did in when me and Steve Dawson got back together again with Pete Gill drumming, we did an album project. We called it Son of a Beach, which obviously was Saxon's original name before we changed it to Saxon when we got a deal and back in 79, because we got told that there was no way under any circumstances could we use that name in the United States. Things might be a little bit easier now, but I doubt it. But at the time, you know, it was just a big
bitch.
No. So
bitch was a real dirty word back in 1979.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we did. Yeah, but it's not a really dirty word in English. It's not such a big deal. I mean, you hear John Wayne saying it all the time, and people don't really look at it upon the same here in England. But we did an album called Victim Mule, and it's a fantastic album. It got some great reviews. But it sort of bubbled underground and never did anything really.
Right.
And the guy that was singing was an American guy called Ted Bullitt. He was from a band called Thunderhead. And at the time, he was living in Germany. I think he's from Connecticut. He's a fantastic singer. So we still do a couple of those songs. You can see some on YouTube. We've done some.
Right.
But mainly, it's the old Saxon ones. And there's that much of a back catalogue that we can really mix it up, you know, depending on what people want to hear.
Very cool. And what is the state of Screaming Eagles at this point?
Screaming Eagles is just something that I got asked to do in the summer. One of the old guys that replaced Steve Dawson put a band together called Screaming Eagles. And he was doing songs from that later period. Obviously, me and Steve Dawson don't play songs like Battle Cry, and from those later albums, Rock the Nations. So it was kind of interesting just standing in to do a couple of gigs with them. But that's all I've done. It's not anything that's permanent. It was just me, you know, just sort of being a guest, just for a bit of fun, really.
Right. Okay.
I think they'd like it to be more, but I haven't got the time. You know.
Yeah. Sure. I mean,
my new album and my new stuff, you know.
So, well, tell us about the new album. Who is producing it with you? Are you guys self-producing it, or do you have an outside producer working on it with you?
Well, we actually started it 5 years ago in a studio in Wales, in England. And the studio was set up by a guy who was something to do with the Lost Prophets. And this guy set up a studio and he bought the entire equipment from Gary Barlow of Take That. Just before that, Take That sort of had the big successful comeback that just had recently. So he had some fantastic equipment because Gary Barlow re-equipped to start doing the new songs. And so this guy bought all this equipment. And we started making this album. And then, unfortunately, they weren't that good business people, and they went into liquidation, which trapped our hard drives in with their, all their equipment. It's not like these days having multi-tracks and big reels of tape that you can sort of take with you every night when you leave. Everything's sort of built into Pro Tools, as you well probably know about modern recording.
Sure.
So we spent a year doing that, and then it went to, and then we got sort of frustrated by this process that happened before the studio. And then about 18 months ago, we actually managed to free our intellectual property, as they call it.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, so we relocated to a studio in Wigan under a guy who used to work with John Astley, which is Pete Townsend's brother-in-law.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, and so we finished off the album, and it took us another year, but it's sounding really fantastic.
And is this this is a music-wise? This is going to be a straight-ahead heavy metal record.
It is. I mean, some of the tracks could have come straight off Wheels of Steel.
Wow.
But it's not. It's not intentional. It's just that me and Steve Dawson were like. A little bit like Tony Iommi and Geezer Butler.
Sure.
Where, in fact, when we play together, we just sound like we sound. And live, we sound like early Saxons because that's what we are. We're not capable of being something different. So it comes out like that when we write. Although we've got a guitarist called Hayden, who's from Barnsley. So the entire band, apart from the singer, Wardy, is still from Barnsley, you know, the Barnsley area. Of England.
Okay.
And so the but as soon as it's finished, I'll send you a copy, and you can, you know, if you review it or whatever.
Oh, you bet. We would love to play it here on, on Talking Metal and the Mark.
Yeah, we'll do that. No problem. Just email you your address, and we'll post you now. Yeah.
When?
But at the moment, we're talking to two or three record companies.
There's no actual release date at this point.
No, the Christmas break obviously is just finished. And everything shuts down from, like, first week of December to basically today. So everybody's getting back into the offices now.
Okay.
There's a guy in Los Angeles got a copy of the album. There's a guy in Germany got a copy of the album. And there's a record company in London. So, but it's very tough out there. I've heard that even Biff can't get a record deal at the moment with his version of Saxon, you know.
Right.
So it's pretty tough, you know, because...
But you're thinking probably definitely this year, sometime in 2011, we'll be hearing this record.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Awesome.
It's all finished, ready. We just got to finalize the name, which we... There's one song called Motorbiker, and we're talking about calling the album that, but at the moment it was just a working title, just to have something to work with. But it's, that's one of the main songs on it, you know, Motorbiker. It's that, you know, Wheels of Steel, that kind of...
Yeah,
I kind of read it, but there's a couple of songs. There's one song on there that was inspired by Lady Gaga. We didn't really. She did a TV show in England, and she dedicated a song to Alexander McQueen. So we wrote a song called "Just Another Suicide," and it's a really. It's like I keep mentioning Wheels of Steel, but when we did that, we did sort of heavy metal thunder type songs or. You know, Machine Gun, which were fast songs. Then we did things like Susie Hold On, which had got real melody. And this is like the Susie Hold On of our album. And it's a real, well, I suppose you'd call it a kind of ballad song, although the lyrical context isn't really about a ballad. It's about torment and anguish, you know. But it's a really good, you know, but... It'll be interesting to see what people make of it when they listen to it. I'll find that intriguing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can't wait to hear it. You've been staying busy with, I guess you could call it a non-musical project, too. You're writing a book with Steve, and this
That's
is going
right.
to actually include a foreword by the one and only Harry Shearer, I understand.
Yes, well, because when Harry Shearer... He came on the road in 1982 with Sax for 1 week. Now, our manager, Nigel Thomas, at the time, is since passed on, but he used to manage Joe Cocker Leon Russell and all kinds of people. And he invested money in movies. And he was a personal friend of the guy that did Blade Runner and Gladiator, whose name I should know.
The guy who did Gladiator and Blade Runner was... we should both know that.
I know, I'm having a senior moment.
Ridley Scott. Right?
So Ridley Scott produced one of our videos, Power and the Glory.
Wow.
Which not many people know. And it was through that connection of movie makers that Ari Shearer came on our tubes for a week. But we didn't know who he was. He wasn't really a famous guy then. And we didn't really know what it was researching. So when we'd done playing, he used to sit in the hotel bars and we just used to relate stories. And one of the stories was about when I played with Motörhead, when Saxon opened for Motörhead in 79 in London. And Motörhead used dry ice and used to test it at soundcheck. And the stage was wet, so I used to start the set with Motorcycle Man, where I'd run into the middle of the stage and playing the intro, or if it's only an A chord, I play it solo before the band come in. But I went flying and landed on my back, and Rob Price, my guitar tech, he ran on and lifted me up in the middle of the stage in the spotlight, still playing this riff. And we told him this story, and that's in the movie, which... And he actually did an interview in Mojo magazine a couple of years ago, well, about 18 months ago, and he said that he did actually base his entire character on Steve Dawson.
Wow.
With the moustache and everything, and the one hand in the air while he's playing open air speaking, you know, which Steve did, you know, and we kind of knew this, but we didn't, it was confirmed to us, because I think every band likes to think that they had a part in Spinal Tap, you know, Ozzy Osbourne or whatever. And
right. Well, it, I mean, it's been rumored, and we've heard stories that you know, Saxon was an influence on, and that even Harry was on tour with you guys. But I never knew that
you guys should get
a writing credit for that. I mean, that's like they're just mimicking what happened to you in real life. That's amazing.
That's right. But sometimes when you watch it, we do feel a bit uncomfortable watching it in a funny kind of way. But we had a meeting with Ari Shearer for 3 hours, and that interview was recorded, and some of that is going to be featured in the book, because this book is going to be really a funny book. You know, it's Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, the Real Spinal Tap. And Ari offered to write the foreword for it. He did it in character as Derek Spalls, you know. So we have the picture and everything. It's fantastic. So, but it took a long time doing. Me and Steve have been at this now for about 3 years, because obviously we've been doing other things, and we're not brilliant typewriting people.
Yeah.
So, you know, like with one finger, it takes all night to do a page. So we've actually got other people to help us start writing this, and we keep breaking off from it and going back to it. But there's going to be a lot of archive photos in as well, so it's an interesting thing to look at, as the pictures as well as, I mean, because we have loads of stories about Ozzy Osbourne. And well, I mean, we started in the punk period,
right?
And supporting the Clash and Sex Pistols, and then we ended up going through all those different phases of music, you know, from Motörhead to Iron Maiden, who used to do gigs together, and then all the Steve Vai and Joe Satriani and Motley Crue. I mean, we toured America with Motley Crue and Rush, and such a diverse kind of a number of years where we sort of transgressed every kind of music to where we are now, you know, which was a really interesting period.
The first time I saw you play was on the Crusader Tour when with Motley Crue, and that was just it was in the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago, and it was just
I remember that. Yeah,
yeah, that was such a great show. I was a fan of both bands. I remember Heavy Penton opened, and then it was Saxon, and then Crue, and I was a fan of both Saxon and Motley Crue. But that night, you guys ruled that night. Definitely.
Oh, cool! That's good.
Blowing the Crue off
the stage. That ballroom is that's where the famous movie was. In the Aragon Ballroom, where they shot the movie.
What movie was that? I'm not sure.
I can't remember that. I know that I remember that gig. I can remember it because I think Bill Ludwig came to that gig as well because of the drumming, you know, of Tommy Lee and Nigel Glockler.
Yeah. So that was just a great memory for me, and. You know, that was, again, on the Crusader Tour for you guys, but one of my favorite Saxon records, and actually one of my favorite records of all time, is Power and the Glory. Any memories you can share about making that record? It seemed like it was maybe a more slick sound in some ways for you guys than what had come beforehand, but it's still...
I mean, we got actually slated for doing Crusader. They said it was too American. And then in England, the Kerrang people said it was... they said it was too American, and then America used to... Some radios wouldn't play it, said it was too English heavy metal. So you sort of caught between a rock and an hard place for a while. You didn't know which way to go, you know. But Power and the Glory we did in Atlanta. And a lot of the riffs for those songs I wrote on the old trusty SG... Paul Quinn and Steve Dawson did Eagle Has Landed. And I remember doing about a month in the studio with a producer called Jeff Glicksman, who'd done, I think, Yngwie Malmsteen and quite a lot of those type of guitar bands.
Yeah.
And so there's actually an album called Diamonds and Nuggets, which is on Angel Air, which is... a whole bunch of studio outtakes. And there's actually a couple of songs on there that didn't make it to Power and the Glory, which are pretty good songs, yeah. Make 'em Rock's one of them, yeah. And
that's called Diamonds and Nuggets.
Diamonds and Nuggets.
And that's a Saxon record. That's under the Saxon
name. It's all it is unreleased Saxon songs. There's like a full... Because you see, in those days, you could only get 27 minutes.
Right.
So no DVDs, CDs or whatever. So you were really limited to vinyl. And so there were always a lot of outtakes where now you can put more tracks on. It's not the case as much. But Diamonds and Nuggets, it's on a record company called Angel Air. So if you Google it, you'll probably find it. But there's some real rarities on that.
Wow.
Everything on there is totally unreleased, plus a couple of outtakes from that recording session.
And is it a legitimate record that's like sanctioned by you guys, or is it more like kind of a bootleg?
Yeah, everybody agreed to put it out, who played on it, which included Paul Quinn and Biff and Nigel Glockley. Yeah, they all get royalties from it. It was sanctioned properly. It's a proper album. And there's a booklet with it with some real interesting rare photographs and things. I think you'd find it interesting. I mean, if you wrote to the guy's called Peter Purnell, and he'd probably send you a copy if you wrote to him, or you might find one over in America on eBay or something.
Cool. Yeah, I'd love to check that out.
I haven't, if I got a copy, I'd send it to you, but I lost my copy a long time ago. People, you know, borrow it and shit and stuff like that. And I've ended up recently buying a couple of albums in America off eBay just because I haven't got them. One in particular was the second wave where we did five tracks. Girls School did five tracks. Tigers of Pantang did five tracks.
Right.
And an ODS, because we just call ourselves ODS, like R.E.M. really. We're sort of trying to ditch the Oliver Dawson sax from being just have like just the ODS. But anyway, we did five tracks each, and that album came out, but it sort of come out and died. It never got distributed properly, and it's called Second Wave. And there's some good stuff on there, and I haven't got a copy because I think I did a radio interview, so I took mine, and they played a track and kept it, you know. because we did some gigs with Girl Skull and on a bit of a tour, and so I ended up having to buy it back myself, which I have to do because it's been deleted now. You can't get it, you know.
Cool. Now, again, I wanted to ask you about touring with Motley Crue. Any crazy memories of just being on tour with that band? Were you guys social with them back in?
Yes, we used to party every night, but I'm a bit like Mick Mars. I'm not such a party animal as the other guys. But we used to have some wild times with Vince Neil, particularly Nikki Sixx.
Right.
Tommy Lee were always off with girls. I mean, he'd just disappear with an handful of girls every night with a Polaroid camera. And then he had a briefcase full of Polaroids, which he'd fetch to the gig the day after to everybody. Wow. Which, some of them Polaroids are somewhere. But that tour that we did when Motley Crue were just breaking, massive, and they were using the lace and the makeup, it were real... turning point, because I think Japan went crazy for that kind of look, you know, the fans in Japan. And I remember playing Bakersfield, and the girls there, they'd just do anything. I mean, it was a real fantastic time to tour, and we sort of covered it in the there was somebody who I met called Kathy Bloomingdale, and she owned the Bloomingdale family from New York.
Right, sure.
But what she's doing now, but she was following Motley Crue around, and I got to meet her, and I think in the end she sort of took off with Vince Neil. I also remember that. Neil, my cow, you know.
So Kathy Bloomingdale, she was from the Bloomingdale family who owned the big stores.
Yeah, that's what she told me, whether it was true or not. But yeah. I think it was true, you know. She'd already tell fibs, you know. Yeah, so there were wild times in those days. I remember doing all those gigs and just a fantastic time. I used to love touring in America. I love the audiences. I love some of the musicians that used to hang out and come and visit us, you know, like Mark Ferrari used to turn up at the hotel and we'd jam, you know. I remember playing the Whiskey A Go Go. It was sold out for four nights.
Wow.
And our support group was Metallica and Rat. And Ozzy Osbourne came to visit us. It was 1 week after Randy Rhoads had been killed. So we didn't really know what to say to Ozzy because he was distraught. I mean, what could you say to the guy? You know, we were looking forward to playing the Whiskey, and it was a big moment for us. And Ozzy were in such a state, we didn't know. You know, we sort of tried to do his best to sort of console him, but you just couldn't. You know, there's just nothing you could do or say. That's a memory I've got that sort of tarnished our debut in Los Angeles. But you know, it couldn't be helped. It was just a really horrible thing that happened.
Yeah, it really was.
And yeah, and I remember it. At the end of the night, there was a knock on the door, and our tour manager came in and said, there's a young Los Angeles band here, and they want to meet you. Their favourite all-time song is Motorcycle Man. And it was Motley Crue, and they trooped in, and that was before they were famous.
Wow.
They were just breaking in LA, you know, so tours, we'd never heard of them. And then a year later, or nearly a couple of years later, we were actually supporting them, which was strange.
There's so much stuff we could talk about, but let's. You mentioned Metallica opening up for you in LA. Yeah. There, Lars Ulrich has gone on to be one of the probably most famous, you know, rock stars. Beyond just a heavy metal star of all time, and one of his favorite bands of all time is Saxon. Any memories of hanging with Lars or meeting Lars?
Well, when we didn't, because Ozzy came to the dressing room with Sharon that night in the Whiskey, we never got to see the band properly. I snuck out and watched a little bit of the show, because I remember this blonde head guitarist with a flying V going nuts, and I think that was Dave Mustaine, because I think
He was still in the
I
band.
I think James had the Black Flying Bee.
Oh, okay.
And that's my memory of that night. And this drummer that were like, a bit like Filthy Animal. You know, like sort of smashing the drums. But every time they play Sheffield, which they've done over the last 20 years, they always invite myself and Steve Dawson. They really look after us. And last year when they came to tour, we were sat in Sheffield Arena. And when the lights went dim for Metallica to come on the stage, the song that they took to the stage with to play the soul, to play their show was Heavy Metal Thunder.
Excellent.
with my guitar solo. So I'm sat there with my guitar solos winging out. There's all these young kids going crazy that Metallica are walking on stage. And I thought, if I told these kids now around me that this is my... This is me playing this, to think I'm a crazy old man, you know. So I'm only 57, so it seems pretty old to me now, you know. So, but that was really surreal. And they use that to play on all around the world. It's on, I've seen it on YouTube in Brazil, you know.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And Lars just said that one of his favourite drummers was Pete Gill of all time, you know, and... In fact, the first thing that they said to me was, James said to me, and I still got that white SG with Jimi Hendrix painted on it, and Kirk said that he was in the audience in San Francisco and played the Keystone. It was just, like a guy in the audience, a kid then. And I was using that guitar, and the white flying beat, it was a big influence. In fact, if you look at early pictures of Kirk Hammett and myself at Donington with the moustache and the white V and stuff, there's a lot of similarities in his look, in my look, whether it's coincidental. I like to think also it's not, I think they definitely took the look as the early Saxon with the spandex and that kind of thing. But interestingly enough, the support band at the Keystone in San Francisco in the Bay Area that night was Cliff Burton's Trauma.
Oh, wow.
And there's photographs somewhere of us together with Trauma on the internet. I did see one. I think some guy who lives in Hawaii took some photos of that night, you know, and posted them on the internet somewhere. So I don't know if you go on my MySpace site. I don't know if you remember MySpace, but you can easily register. If not, I've put a ton of photographs on there, old and new, and a load of tour passes. So if there's anything you ever need to download, you know, you can. I think you can pull things off there. You know, like Ozzy Osbourne. Backstage pass, because actually when we played Journey once, Ozzy Osbourne were our support band, because Saxon were that big in 1980, you know. So I got to hang out with Randy Rhoads and he played my Flying V and all kinds of stuff, you know. I'd like to talk to guys at Gibson, you know, but it's pretty hard getting through to them sometimes,
yeah.
You know.
Well, I was going to, a couple things I wanted to cover before we let you go, but you mentioned your MySpace page. Can you give the exact website? It's obviously MySpace.com
It's MySpace/ Graham Oliver Solo.
Graham Oliver.
So you'll find it dead easy.
Okay.
Just Graham Oliver, MySpace, Graham Oliver Solo. And I think even if you click onto Google now in England, it comes up under Google, you know.
Okay, good. And, well, we'll be sure for the listeners out there who are listening to this podcast, we'll be sure to link that in today's show notes on talkingmetal.com. You mentioned, let's talk about Gibson. What are your, I know you're a big player of Gibson guitars. What are some of your favorite Gibson models to play?
Well, my SG, which I bought in 1972, I still use that guitar. And it took me like years to pay for it, you know, on a weekly payment basis. And I've had that guitar throughout my entire career, and I still use it from time to time. And then in 1979, I bought We was actually on the Motorhead tour, the Bomber tour. I bought a brand new for IMB. It's a 79. It's a whitey cream colour, but it's got block inlays. And apparently the block inlays are really, really rare. And Randy Rhodes wanted to swap me one of his Spot guitars, it's Jackson's, for this Flying V, but I didn't really like the Charvel Jackson's. I mean, I think it joined the body at the 13th fretos. You couldn't really play it up the neck, you know, it was really tough to play. I think Randy used to use it occasionally. In fact, that tour, he nearly 90% used the white Les Paul. But we used to swap guitars. Randy would play my Flying V, and I'd play Spotty guitar with the Red House in B. But so that's one of my favourite guitars. I'd never really swap it or get rid of it now. But I think Flying V's and SG's are my favourite Gibsons.
Excellent.
I've got a couple of SG's, you know. I've got a beautiful Pelham Blue one that I use, which is an SG 90, an 88 model, with Trini Lopez inlays. And that's a favourite, you know. I just use it for, like, recording and stuff. Then I've got, you know, that's been my main interest. I've got a couple of Fenders and things like that, and modern guitar, because sometimes you have to do the modern trend stuff, you know, just to keep up with things. But my main squeeze is my old SG and Flying V.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned Randy Rhodes again, and now Ozzy, again, when you guys were touring with Ozzy, that was with Rudy Sarzo and Tommy Aldridge, I believe, which was that when they were supporting Diary, I guess, right?
That was the German tour in 1980, and we did France as well. And funnily enough, on the last show in Germany, all the band turned up at soundcheck, and we used to go and watch soundcheck every week, because Pete, we used to love watching Tommy Aldridge and stuff, you know, at soundcheck and Randy. So they all set up and ready to play. This was about 7:30, about 5 minutes before the doors opened, and the tour manager came in and said to the crew, "Right, get all the gear off stage." And the band was saying, "Why, what's happened? Ozzy's in London with Sharon." So it just took off to London from Germany, and never even told his band, you know. The only Ozzy could do that and get away with it, you know.
And then obviously that show was cancelled, and then he cancelled. Well,
it was cancelled for all these. We still played, obviously.
Yeah.
But there were some people pissed who big Ozzy fans, you know.
Yeah.
The Germans. But the show went to red, but it was a shame, really, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a memory of that. And just hanging out with Randy, really, and talking guitars. I mean, he spent more time playing guitar, in his dressing room than any other guitarist I've ever known.
Wow.
Plus that, and doing his hair with an hairdryer. He was really meticulous about how he looked. He really took care of his appearance, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And just recently, I've had the pleasure of working in Italy with Uli John Roth.
Oh, wow.
There's some pictures on MySpace of me and Uli together on my MySpace. And we did a bunch of Hendrix stuff and early Scorpions, Polar Nights and things. We played L'Aquila, which was devastated by an earthquake just before it was destroyed, you know. So it was really good. I've been enjoying playing with other guitar players and sort of doing different things this last 10 years. Whereas before, you know, in my early years, it was just straight Saxon and never deviated from doing his own songs.
Right.
Whereas I've been doing, I mean, Hendrix stuff. I saw Jimi Hendrix play in 1967 when I was a kid at Sheffield. So I've always been a massive fan all my life. In fact, when I came to America, one of the first things I did in Seattle was visit his father and his grandmother. She was 101 when I met Nora.
Wow.
I told Uli Roth that I met Nora, and he goes, "You met Nora?" I says, "Yeah." He couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And they were really nice. Al Hendrix was really a gentleman and showed me all Jimmy's gear, what he got at the house in near Renton. That was really interesting. And
well, I bet, you know, when people like you would go to visit Jimmy's family. That really probably had to make them happy too, you know, because you were going to did. Pay
well,
respect.
I read that Alan Rich used to play the spoons, you know, which is a really funny thing in England. People do it when they're drunk at parties, play the spoons. I don't know if it's something that Americans, if you're familiar with it.
Play like spoons? Like
yeah, you put two spoons together and you bang them out. It's something like, you know, it's and I said to Alan Rich, do you still play the spoons out? He said, no, I eat my soup with him now, which was a really funny thing for him to say.
Yeah.
But one of the funniest things, because I said to him, you know, I come in the phone book, so he says, well, if I went in the phone book, you wouldn't be able to phone me up and come and visit, which was true, you know. And then I got home from that tour, and we'd just done a few gigs with Iron Maiden in America as well. And Dave Murray knew that I'd been to see Al Hendrix, because he's a massive Hendrix fan. And he phoned me up in England. It was in Seattle. They'd just done a show. And it was. I think he got me out of bed. He said, Graham, it's Dave Murray. You haven't got Al's number. I want to go and visit him. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, so I never knew if he did. I never asked him if he went to visit. But that was strange. Dave Murray ringing me in the early hours of the morning for Al Hendrix's number. Yeah.
Wow.
That was thing. So all these things are going in the book, obviously, you know, but like you said, there's a ton of stuff because it just covers such a long period and such a diverse, you know, kind of stuff that we got up to. I mean, one of the highlights in my life was touring with Rush, the first American tour, because every gig was sold out, Philly Spectrum, you know, and Rush were doing stuff like Tom Sawyer, Limelight, just before they released the album.
Okay.
So they're trying these songs out, so I went to see Rush on the last English tour, and it just fetched so many memories back, you know.
Yeah, sure. And before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about your son, Paul. Is he still playing drums?
Yes, he is. He's actually playing drums for me in Belgium this next 3 days.
Oh, excellent.
Nigel Durham, he's torn a muscle in his arm. He did it about 4 years ago, and it will not heal. After he's done about 2 or 3 gigs, he gets into real serious pain, and in fact, he can't play properly, and it keeps it's like a recurring injury, and it got that bad in Finland before Christmas, that he's got to have a year off to let it heal properly. It's been told by the specialist if he doesn't let it heal properly, when he goes to hit the cymbals. And the specialist told him if he doesn't let it heal properly, it'll do serious damage for life that is irreversible. So that's what he's got to do. And so my son is my son actually drummed for Motörhead at soundchecks, because my son Paul used to be a drummer for the drum tech for Nigel Glockler for about...
Oh, really? Okay.
For 7 years.
And he played, Paul actually played on your solo record too, End of Era.
He did, yes, he did. So he did that, and he's a bit like Pete Gill, although he was friends with Nigel Glockler. He was very much influenced by Gill's kind of playing, and he's that kind of player. So the last couple of shows we've done and rehearsals with Paul, it's strange playing those Wheels of Steel songs with a single kit, with that kind of Pete Gill feel again. In fact, it's been quite enlightening and enjoyable, you know, because Nigel's very much an 80s rock drummer, you know, twirling the sticks and double kicks all over the place, you know.
Right.
So you start playing the riffs with different accents, and you get into some, not bad habits, but, the little things creep into the song, so... When Paul came in, we took the song way back and we had to learn them again, how they were written in the first place, which is a good thing, you know.
Right. Cool. Well, Graham, thank you so much for coming on the Talking Metal podcast. We really appreciate it.
I hope people can understand my accent.
Oh, yeah. I could understand you, for sure.
Yeah, okay, because sometimes I had a problem. If I'd have written on, I should have talked a little bit slower off. But, you know, because if you're saying we're going to the bar, they understand us. And what was Yorkshire people, if we were touring, we said to his American friends, we're going to the bar. And they think, hey, say what, you know.
Right, right. Right.
So you, well, it's like you're saying we're going to the bad, and the all shows to understand this. So.
No, I could understand probably 98% of everything you said. I think we're good. But if we could get you saying your name and you are listening to Talking Metal before we let you go, that would be great. Anytime you're ready.
Okay. Hi, my name is Graham Oliver, the founder member of Saxon, still rocking after all these years. And you're listening to Talking Metal. It's going to rock the hairs off your legs. Be there or be square.
Great ID. Thank you very much, Graham. And we can't wait to read the book. We can't wait to hear the new music. I have your email. I have your home phone number here, so I will be in touch. I'm going to be on you to hear this stuff and read the book.
Yeah, don't forget to mail me your address so I can send you the album.
I will do that. Thank you very much for your time, and thanks for staying up late to talk to us.
Okay, Mark, it was a pleasure.
We'll talk to you soon.
See you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.